the Writers' Voices. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and we have a kind of a fun guest today for me because, well, you'll see as we get into it, And my normal co-host, my regular co-host, my mother, Caroline Kilburn, is not with us today, although she would have had fun with this book too. Let me introduce our author, Kathy Giroux. She was born in Washington, D.C. to a family of natural storytellers and has expressed her intellectual, creative, and spiritual curiosity through multiple reinventions. Upon graduating from Northern Illinois University, Giroux embarked on a 30-year career as a special ed teacher. She retired from teaching at age 50 and joined a local writers group. Encouraged by supportive and accomplished writers, she decided to put her stories into a book, which is called Serious Little Catholics. Now, this follows a girl growing up in the mid-1950s and 60s as the oldest of seven children making their way through Catholic school. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Kathy.
Thank you for having me.
Now, one of the first, the reason this is kind of fun for me is that although I'm a little younger than you, not much, and although I didn't go to Catholic school, I was raised Catholic, and so there are a lot of the stories that you tell that I can identify with.
I get that from a lot of people.
I bet you do. So, why don't you tell us? I mean, the intro kind of told us why you decided to write this book, but you know, you're also telling a lot of stories about your family, and so I'm curious as to how they, you know, how you felt about and how they felt about you writing this.
You know, they were just fine with it, and it's interesting. One of the things that people ask me about is how can you remember all of that stuff that happened. And whenever we would get together, we'd tell stories. Remember when this happened? So it's kind of a, you know, something that's part of our family history is remember when this happened, remember the silly thing that happened. And of course they all kind of remember it a little differently, I've discovered, but it's always been fun to kind of rehash it. Now it's down there so everybody else can see it too.
Now, before you published, did you send out a draft to your siblings and say, hey, read this over and make sure, you know, to make sure that they were okay with how they were being portrayed?
Yes, I did to the two children that are mainly, and they're the children on the cover, my two younger brothers that were actually in school with me. So they knew that. I also sent out one of the stories about Christmas. I sent that out as my Christmas letter, things like that. So people were pretty well aware of what was in there.
And what kind of response have you gotten?
Very good response. Very good response from my family. My mother, who passed away just last year, I'm not sure how well she would have liked it, although she did, you know, read some of it and so on. She was aware of some of it. But there were a few stories that were very honest, but, you know, she didn't particularly appreciate it.
I you know, so I'm from a family of five, mm-hmm. and I'm the oldest girl. I have one older brother. Like I said, we did not go to Catholic school, but we were raised Catholic. And when we don't really tell stories about that so much, but the other, you know, the whole childhood story thing, I think when we get together and tell these stories, it does make my mother a little uncomfortable sometimes because I think she feels like we're laughing about all the things that she did wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that's not really what it is.
Yeah,
it's like if you remember those things, they're like they just become so much a part of who you become, whether they look, you know, right or wrong from now, they're part of who you are.
That's right. And parenting is not an easy job. There's no, you know, you kind of got to fuddle through it yourself. You can't, you know, so it's not that anybody did anything wrong so much as they just, I'll try this and see if it works kind of thing.
Yeah. So of your family, how many stay, you know, grew up to be practicing Catholics?
One. And that's because of his wife, I think, really. The only one.
And can you kind of give me an overview of how the rest, what the rest, their spiritual life became, sort of?
You know, I have a lot of my family married people from really different religions. So one of them is Muslim, one of them is Baha'i. And then there are some, I don't want to, agnostics, I guess I'll say. So it's, you know, we've got a lot of different kinds of religious backgrounds in our family, and that's just fine with all of us, including my parents. They were just fine with that. And I think it actually makes us more spiritual, because we go, tell us about what you think. And, you know, this thing of, okay, well, I can, you know, there's similarities in every religion, and mostly it's about treating people nice.
Yeah, it doesn't always work out that way, though, does it?
but we do a pretty good job of it, I think, in our family.
Well, that's good. That's good. So tell us a little bit about your own spiritual journey.
Well, you know, for a while, I like to say I was really drinking the Kool-Aid, because, you know, I was really believing everything that I was told. And then I started to question. And two things made me start to question what they were telling me. One of them was I had a kitty that was like, you know, gosh, she's part of the family. She's just a wonderful little cat. And of course, we were told by the nuns that there's no animals in heaven. And I thought, well, how can that be heaven if there's, you know, if my cat's not going to be there when I die? And then the other one was I have Protestant grandparents. And at that time, I don't think it's the case so much anymore with the church, but at that time, you know, they were not going to be able to go to heaven either. And I just didn't think that was fair. So those were the things.
Well, things, yeah. And of course, some of that doctrine has changed.
Yes, it really has. But, you know, it changed, but, you know, not until too late for me, I guess. It, you know.
So you went to, you were taught by nuns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that'll teach you.
And we had some nuns at our church from time to time. But I only ever had nice nuns.
Mm-hmm.
So did you have both kinds?
Yes, absolutely. Some of them were very nice. And then there was one that was particularly evil. But I think the meanest teacher I had was not a nun. She was a lay teacher. She was just mean. Aww. And quite frankly, I can remember, this was third grade, and I can remember thinking to myself, I could probably do a better job being a teacher than her. And I think that was the little seed that was planted about, okay, maybe that's what I'll do when I grow up.
And in your bio, it said that you taught special ed. That's a pretty challenging, I would expect, type of teaching.
Yeah, it was. There was a lot of, it was in a middle school. So actually I had middle school students that I had to teach one little 20-minute class to, and I was so glad to give them back. Because my special ed kids loved me. Yeah.
Aww.
And I never outgrew that, oh, teachers are wonderful thing. So,
So what is that, what drew you to teaching special ed?
You know, I had worked in a nursing home for really severely handicapped kids when I was in high school. And I was just fascinated by that population. And so they were giving scholarships back then for anybody who would go into special ed. And so it was a good way for me to pay it for college. And I really enjoyed it.
I bet. But you retired, it said, at 50, which is fairly young to retire.
I did. I was financially able to do that for one thing, which was great. But I also saw so many teachers that that kind of, how should I say this, overstayed their limit of patience, you know, where they and I wanted to get out while I was still, you know, I still liked it. I still loved what I was doing. I didn't want to get to the point where I was like, oh my gosh, I can't do this anymore.
Oh, wow. That's smart.
Yeah.
So you retired and you joined a writer's group, but did you think right away, I want to work on a book? Or tell us a little bit about how that came about.
Well, I had always liked writing. I can remember trying to write a story when I was, you know, really young, but my spelling is so terrible that I just kind of gave up. So now that there's spell check, I went, I'm going to do this. And it was interesting because I thought, oh, I know how to write. I wrote all kinds of stuff. Mostly it was, you know, incident reports and IEPs and stuff, you know, from school, you know, it was all nonfiction. So I really had to learn how to make it interesting. And that's what my writers group really helped me with. And that encouraging me that this was good enough to publish.
How did you find your writers group?
You know, I got invited by a woman that I knew. She said, you know, oh you, because I had been playing with writing. You know, I wrote a book that was ended up being pretty terrible that's still on the shelf. But anyway, she said, oh, you should join the run group. So she actually invited me into it.
And is it, tell me a little bit more about how the structure of it and how it works.
We get together every other week and we write something or not, and we read it to everybody and they critique it, and then we do it all over again.
So do you write during the meetings, or you bring something from before?
We bring something, enough copies for everyone to have one and to make comments all over, you know, write all over it and make comments. Yeah.
And how many people?
Right now, I think we have 15 in the writing group. Not everybody comes all the time.
Well, that's fairly large. Now, are any of them other than you published writers at this point?
Yes. Two of them are traditionally published. We have a couple of people, I think, that have self-published.
Wow. And what type of writing is it? You know, yours is memoir. Mm-hmm.
There's another memoir. The kind of leader of the group is writing a memoir about her husband who passed away of cancer. So she's writing how that process was. She hasn't published it yet, but she's going to do it, I think. And then one was historical romance. Another one is a bunch of short stories that are kind of around the theme of the title of it, is it The Good Dishes? So they all have something about dishes in them.
So that's really kind of interesting because my sister always had this idea for a children's story about the dish at the bottom of the stack that never gets used.
Oh, poor sad little dish. That does sound like a kid's story.
Yeah. So what is your writing process like?
My writing process is to just put everything down and don't edit it. Just write it. Just write it. Just write it. And I'll write, you know, a chapter or two, and then I'll go back and I'll fine tune it. And then I'll, you know, write some more and then fine tune it. I spend an awful lot of time on rewriting, and I like to kind of rewrite as I go rather than write a first draft that's not any good. The whole thing. I think it's a little easier when you've got, these are basically little short stories that get put together. That's an easier thing than writing a novel. And I also didn't write these in any kind of order. I went, oh, I remember that. That'll be funny. Or one of my siblings will say, remember when this happened? I go, oh, yeah. So I kind of had to then take all of these and go, okay, you know, let's put these in a chronological order. I thought that was a logical thing to do.
That does make a lot of sense. So you're starting in kindergarten?
Yes.
Yeah. And you go clear through?
Eighth grade.
High school.
Eighth grade. Yeah.
Eighth grade. Okay. And so you weren't in Catholic school anymore after eighth grade. Is that why you stopped at that point?
Yeah, I think so. And it just felt done. It felt like it was done. It felt like high school would have to be a whole nother book.
So why don't you share a couple of stories, share one from the earlier years and then maybe one from your middle school years.
So I'm going to read the first one, and it's called Devil in the Rhubarb. And it takes place kindergarten in 1956. Sister Felicia, my first catechism teacher, was so serious. Then a great big snake slithered down the trunk of the tree of knowledge and spoke to Eve. "Take a bite of my nice juicy red apple," he tempted her. Sister stopped to make sure we were listening. Now, Eve knew that God told Adam they could eat anything in the garden they wanted except the apples from this special tree. But the snake was so charming and told such clever lies that she took a bite anyway. You see, that snake was really the devil. I was already in kindergarten, and along with learning to write my name, count to 100, and color inside the lines, I was learning to be a Catholic. It was a complicated process with prayers to memorize, rules to follow, and now this, the devil. My kindergarten was in a public school, which I found out later was an inferior kind of education from a Catholic point of view. So I was getting my catechism from Sister Felicia, a scrawny old nun at St. Mary's. I'd been going to class an hour before Mass every Sunday for almost 2 years now. Finally, we were getting to the seriously scary stuff. "The devil lives down in hell," Sister said, pointing to the floor, "underground in the fiery center of the earth. But he comes up out of the dark place sometimes to tempt us, just like he did to Eve. You must be very watchful and think about what you're doing. Always ask yourself, would God like it if I did this? If the answer is no, that idea is coming from the devil." I had a lot to think about as I sat through Mass that Sunday, and for once the boring Latin droning didn't make it hard to keep my eyes open. The devil was apt to be around every corner, in disguise, trying to get me to do naughty things, and because I was a girl, I was especially in danger. After all, if Eve, a grown-up woman, had been fooled, I must be very careful. Monday afternoon, I was walking home from school with my best friend, Dana, when I noticed trouble at the corner. A huge hole, surrounded by sawhorses, opened up where the sewer drain had been the day before. We tiptoed up to the gaping cavity. It was deep and dark and impossible to see the bottom, but a rusty metal ladder with rounded rungs and splatters of orange paint leaned against one side of the cracked concrete. "Get back!" I screamed at Dana, grabbing the sleeve of her sweater and pulling her safely behind me. "I think it goes all the way down to hell. The devil might be trying to climb out and tempt us." "What are you talking about?" Dana did not go to Sunday school at St. Mary's. Good thing I was there to save her. Sister Felicia told us all about Adam and Eve and the snake devil and how hell is at the center of the earth and how we have to be careful because the devil will come up and make us do bad things so that he can take us down to hell to live with him after we die. "Really?" Dana peered around me toward the mouth of hell. She just couldn't help herself, not being Catholic and all. "Yeah, really," I said. Just then we heard clanging and banging from the depths of the pit. There was definitely something in there, and it was trying to get out. "I told you so." We ran the last few blocks back to our own neighborhood. Safe at home, I hurried to change out of my school clothes and ran over to Dana's across the street to play. She had a really nice house with a gigantic backyard, a tire swing, and a huge garden with things starting to poke out of the ground in the neat straight rows. "Want some rhubarb? It's big enough to eat now," Dana offered. "We can pick it. Then we'll go inside and get a bowl of sugar for Mom to dip it in." I almost tasted it already as we ran for the patch of big fluffy leaves, their red-green stems waiting beneath, focused on choosing the perfect stalk, small enough to fit in my mouth but big enough to load up with sugar. I didn't notice what slithered toward me until it was too late. The snake slid across the white toe of my saddle shoe. I froze in terror, waiting for him to get off, then ran screaming from the yard, across the street, through our screen door, letting it bang shut behind me. But I did not stop there. I ran all the way into my parents' bedroom, flung open the rarely used attic door, and ran up the rickety steps to hole up behind boxes full of old stuff. That's where my mother found me, what seemed like hours later, still petrified. "What on earth happened to you?" she said, holding me close to calm me down. "The devil! He climbed out of hell and followed me and Dana home from school. He was hiding in the rhubarb."
Now, did your mother remember that?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, she was the one that told the story from her point of view, going, "I can figure out why we were up in the attic."
Oh.
Yeah. So that was a funny one. Now, do we have time for another one?
Yes.
Okay, so let me see here if I can find. I'm going to do Limbo. This is fifth grade. My new religion teacher, Sister Mary Bridget, announced on the first day of school, "We are starting a crusade at St. Catherine's to help the Catholic missions in Africa. His Eminence, Pope John the 23rd, is offering Catholic school children the opportunity to buy pagan babies. They cost $13 apiece." She wrote a big 13 with a dollar sign on the chalkboard. "What I want you all to do is ask your relatives and friends to donate to our cause. You can help too. Many of you get an allowance or money for your birthday. Surely you can spare some of it to save innocent little babies." She stopped talking to make sure everyone was quiet and looking at her. "As you know, any baby who dies without being baptized, even if he hasn't a single sin on his tiny soul, never gets to see God. He goes to a place that is just as nice as heaven, called Limbo, except that God never comes down there to see him. What a sad and tragic thing." Sister Mary Bridget was beside herself about it. "I'd been hearing about Limbo and the poor pagan babies almost from the beginning of learning how to be a good Catholic, but since I was baptized and it didn't apply to me, I never paid much attention. Still, Sister did get me feeling sorry for the little kids in Africa. I went home and tried to panhandle my parents, but Steve got there first. All the grades were buying babies. Then I emptied my piggy bank. I counted almost $2, a huge donation from a kid who got no allowance and had to make her birthday money last all year. On the second day of school, our regular teacher, Miss Harris, collected our offering. She was going to be the banker while Sister Bridget gave us a pep talk every day. I am proud of you, children. We have collected $32.13, enough to buy 1.5 babies." Chalk dust poofed from Sister Bridget's palms as she clapped in delight. "I can't tell you how important it is that a person be baptized as a Catholic. When the missionaries go to the dangerous jungles of Africa, the first thing they do is teach the natives about Jesus. In a place where you could get eaten by a lion any minute, it's important to receive the sacrament as soon as possible." Sister looked over us, waiting for questions. "Yes, Virginia, you have your hand up. Sister, how many pagan babies do you think there are in Limbo?" "Oh, millions. Remember, Limbo is forever. So all of the pagan babies that were ever born there, except the ones who are alive right now and waiting for us to save them." "And there are older people too?" "Yes, there are a very few good people who never did anything to anger God. He made Limbo as a refuge from the torments of hell for them, too." Richard Klepper raised his hand but started talking before she called on him. "Sister, let me see if I have this right." Robert was always bugging the nuns to get us kids to laugh. "The only people in heaven are holy Catholics, a bunch of angels, and God." "That's what I just said, Mr. Klepper." Sister Bridget was always suspicious when Robert asked a question. "Well, what about Moses and Noah and all those guys in the Old Testament that died before Jesus came along to save them? They did all that work for God, and it's sorry, you guys. You don't get to see me. Tough luck." "Well, Robert," Sister put her "I'm not going to tolerate any nonsense" face, "you obviously need to refresh yourself on your Easter mysteries. Does the phrase Limbo of the Fathers ring a bell?" Robert's flabbergasted face told us he realized he'd walk right into a trap. "No, Sister." "Well, then, for homework tonight, you will look it up and write a report. Then read it in front of the class tomorrow." I thought hard about the Limbo thing all the way home that day. I had grandparents who were not Catholic. Grandpa Fryer was a physics professor and, according to what my dad said, really didn't have much use for God. The way it looked, he was probably going to hell no matter what. On the other hand, Grandma Fryer was the sweetest lady in the world. She didn't deserve to be punished. The problem was Limbo was crawling with babies. Grandma always seemed a bit overwhelmed when her son visited with all us kids. Even if it did look just like heaven, a place with millions of fussy babies would be Grandma's hell. It didn't seem fair, and I decided not to believe it. Robert stood in front of the class trying not to laugh. The Limbo of the Fathers was the abode of people who, before Jesus' resurrection, had died in the friendship of God, but had to wait for Jesus Christ to open heaven's gates. Limbo was where they were kept until Christ's soul traveled there after the crucifixion and led them into heaven. All right, Mr. Klepper, Sister Bridget said with authority. Do you understand now that everyone who should be in heaven goes to heaven, and anyone who deserves to be in hell will end up there, no matter how smart he thinks he is? Yes, sister. Robert was pretending to be penitent, but we all knew better. He was obviously having a full-blown crisis of faith and taking most of us with him.
And that was Kathy Giroux reading from Serious Little Catholics. I, too, remember being a serious little Catholic, thinking that I would want to be a nun when I grew up, even wanting to go to the convent boarding school at one point. I'm not quite sure why that didn't happen. I should ask my mom if she remembers
that. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, of course, First Communion.
Mm-hmm.
And I have this memory of... I don't know if it's from a photograph or something where I later realizing that I had done it wrong, because when I held my hands, like prayer hands, they were like up in front of my mouth,
uh-huh.
and everybody else was down like by their waist.
Uh-huh.
I'm not quite sure how I got that so wrong.
Getting your hands were in that way, weren't they? Yeah. I can remember in one of the stories is about that, you know, that we had lessons of, you know, how to do this. And my God, don't stick your finger in your mouth if it gets stuck to the roof of your mouth, you know, all that kind of stuff, you know, oh, you can't touch it. And that's really, you know, bad.
Yeah. Yeah. Now you have a chapter in here about indulgences. Mm-hmm. What are those?
Okay, so indulgences were years that you got for praying. So, and we had a little book, and it had in there, for example, Hail Mary. If you say one Hail Mary, you get, I don't remember offhand now, 10 years of indulgence, and you get all those indulgence years added up, and then you can, if you go to purgatory, which is about everybody does, because you can't be that perfect, that's years off your sentence in purgatory. And that was one of the things that Martin Luther didn't like about the Catholic Church, because they were actually selling indulgences. So other people would pray for you, you'd pay them to pray for you, and then you'd get the indulgences so that you could go right to heaven. So that's what that was about. And I actually found that out and decided to start writing stuff down. And then, of course, later on, I think I was in, I can't remember, 8th grade, maybe, where they took those indulgences away. And I'm like, all that praying for nothing.
So when you say they took them away, what does that
mean? Well, they just said you can't do that anymore. That we're not going to have indulgences anymore. It was one of the, you know, every once in a while they change the rules. The Pope changes the rules. That was one of those. I think it was a Vatican Council or something. I can't exactly remember it offhand. I'd have to look it up. But it was something that I remember people still doing. And actually, you could take some of your indulgences and give them to somebody else who had died and say, okay, I'm going to give you some of mine so that maybe that'll help you stay out of hell too. Which there's another story about that.
Like when they change the rules, mm-hmm. are they saying that, yes, this used to be true, but now it's not true anymore? Or are they saying, well, this never really worked?
You know, they didn't really specify that. It's just that, you know, if you had indulgences, they were no good anymore. You couldn't use them. It's kind of like, you know.
Yeah, but it's like people aren't making the rules about heaven.
Yeah, that's right. No, that was one of the things. It's, you know, it's some pope that's doing this, or bishops or whatever. It is still that way.
Yeah. Now, after you became an adult and you stopped believing most of what you were taught mm-hmm. in Catholic school, where did your spiritual interests go?
More to metaphysical things. Another career I have is I'm I am a tarot card reader, so which of course the church hates that. I've got a lot of grief from that, from the church, but it didn't bother me. But more just the spirituality of again doing what is kind, doing what is right, doing, you know, without a ton of rules around it. Just, you know, that, you know, if you wouldn't want somebody doing something to you, don't do it to them. And the other thing is that one of my brothers is gay. So, you know, how could I, you know, they're still not very, they're a little nicer about that, but still not great, you know? So, you know, I saw these other people in my life who are the ones that are supposedly going to hell for no fault of their own. So.
Now, a lot of that belief has sort of been modified in the church too, hasn't it?
Particularly with this newer Pope, it has. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So have you ever thought about going back?
Oh, you know, I still go to weddings at churches. I still go to, but no, not really. You know, I've got kind of better things to do on my Sunday morning, quite frankly.
So tell us a little bit about the tarot card reading.
Okay. So it's a, you know, a fun thing that I do. I have a fairly thriving business that kind of is just getting started again now that I can see people in person, but I do it with a friend of mine. We were asked to do this for a fundraiser just for fun, and we had so much fun doing it. It was for the symphony, and they were doing the opera Carmen, which of course there's the gypsy tarot reader in that. So we did it, and on the way out, we went, this is really fun. Maybe we could start a little business. And we didn't think we'd be that popular, but actually we've been doing it now for 20 years.
Wow. So do you really believe in it?
You know, what I go on is the feedback I get from people, you know, because I don't ask them any questions. I just do my thing and then say, does this make any sense? And sometimes they'll tell me, yes, it does. And that's all they tell me. And sometimes they'll tell me their whole life story. So, matter. You know, it seems to, I couldn't tell you how it works. I don't think it's anything too creepy. I think it's just, you know, I've learned to really listen to my intuition about what to tell people. When that card comes up, I don't ever say the same thing about the card to everyone. So it's kind of like, well, this feels like this is about, you know, your job, or this feels like this is about your relationship, you know, those kinds of things. So, you know, like I said, I get a lot of good feedback from it.
Do you use the cards to guide yourself?
Sometimes I do. Yeah, sometimes I do. I have a pretty good intuition about stuff. You know, a lot of times I go, oh, boy, this doesn't feel right. And then I go ahead and do something anyway. And I go, oh, yeah, I should have listened to myself. You know, that kind of thing.
It almost sounds like the cards are almost kind of a jumping off point for to think deeply about something.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people do that with prayer. You know, they pray and then they get inspiration from praying. I don't want to say it's the same thing, but it is a means to sort out what your problem is.
Yeah, and that your thoughts about
thoughts it. About it. Yeah.
Yeah, and maybe you can get indulgences for it.
You know, my mother was cleaning out our house and she gave me a bunch of stuff she gave me my little missals. She gave me my rosary. She gave me my scapular. And she also gave me that notebook. It was really fun to see those things.
Now, do you feel like some of the kind of mysticism that you were taught as a serious little Catholic made you more open to other types of mysticism, like tarot?
You know, I think so. You know, one of the things about it that I really, you know, when I really liked the miracles, the saints that had all these weird things that would happen to them, they were burned and then they were fine the next day, that kind of thing. That's, or some angel that comes down and, does something for them. That was my favorite part. I like that stuff. And it was all just, somebody who's very living in the agnostic or in the place, of true science, I guess maybe that's a better word from it, that would just go, oh, well, this is just the silly part of it. but, that silly things sometimes really do happen.
Well, that's true. Miracles obviously happen. Unexplained things happen all the time. But the problem is that, like, if you pray for a miracle, mm-hmm. or if somebody has a serious illness and gets better, and this is an issue I've always had, and people say, oh, it was because we prayed for them, mm-hmm. and so God cured them. Well, what about all the people that people prayed and prayed for, and they still mm-hmm. died? Yeah. It's like, is God playing favorites? What's going on here?
Yeah.
I always felt a little uncomfortable about that.
Yeah, that is true. And prayer is really just focusing an intention. It's focusing your energy on something, and that's the same as things that other people do. I also am trained as a Reiki master. I don't know if you know what that is. It's a
Well, considering that I live in Fairfield, Iowa, I don't know if you know what that is, but
I do. I've been wanting to get there. I haven't made it yet.
Okay. So yes, right. I know what Reiki is, but go on and explain it for those who might not.
So that is, and it does sometimes work. Again, it doesn't always, but I've seen some kind of really interesting results of doing that. And I think that is kind of a prayer also, and it's about, first of all, believing that it's possible, and also giving it your intention to do what is the best for the person, because sometimes the best thing for the person may not be to get better, that may not be what their destiny is, or whatever you want to call it, or it may be that it's just not, it's their time to go. So but I have seen things happen that I go, boy, that's really amazing. Because sometimes I kind of doubt it myself, I go, I'm just doing this.
I have, I haven't had a lot of experience with Reiki, but I did have a friend who practiced it, and a couple of friends who practiced it, and I was going through something really, really challenging, and they did a session for me, and it did make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah,
I think it's as with anything, it's worth a try.
Yeah, yeah. You're listening to Writer's Voices. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Kathy Giroux, author of Serious Little Catholics. Now, you have, this is published by She Writes Press, and we've had a number of really excellent authors from She Writes. Can you tell us how it works?
Okay, so She Writes is what they call a hybrid publisher. And really what that means is that you're kind of expected to invest in your own book. So you pay money up front, but then you get more of what the book sells for. So you get your money back if it sells, basically. And, for what you pay, you get edited, you get a cover made, you get a lot of services, you get a lot of workshops that tell you about marketing and things like that. You get suggestions about publicists that they've worked with before. So I've been very happy with it. I think most authors understand that you're not probably going to make a lot of money on your book. You'll be really lucky to break even, but that's not why a lot of people write, I don't think.
Right. And also, by getting a book out there, if you keep writing, the next one,
you might be able to break into where you are actually
making
money.
That's right. Yeah, you can get more, a little more of a following and so on. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what are your plans for writing in the future?
Well, I'm actually working on a novel right now because, you know, during COVID, it's like, what am I going to do? I might as well do this. And it's actually what I would call a paranormal romance. So something completely different. But
completely different.
And it's based on an experience that I had, really. And it's about a shamanic journey, which is a Native American kind of ritual, I guess, where you when you have a question, instead of praying to God about it or throwing out tarot cards, you do a shamanic journey where you go into the underworld and you have a spirit animal, and you know, so it's an interesting thing. And completely different. The other thing is it's a novel, which is a whole lot harder than writing, you know, stringing together a bunch of short stories. That's easier.
Are you the main character in the novel?
No, it's all fictional. fictional. It's actually the main character. You know, I did this when I was older and married. And this is a young single woman who's having boy problems. So, yeah. So, yeah, and with an older sister who's kind of into this stuff. So I'm more like the older sister, I think.
Well, Kathy, why don't you read one more story from Serious Little Catholics?
I'm going to read my favorite one, I think. I think it's fourth grade. Urinals is the name of it. So even the title cracked me up.
Yes, yep.
Okay, so St. Catherine's campus had been planned with great precaution. The church, of course, was separate from the stuccoed school building, whose only decoration was the gold-painted cross over the front door. Between the two buildings sat a matching pair of blacktop playgrounds, one for girls and one for boys, separated by a ribbon of grass planted with a few trees. Catholic kids were always having to go to church. There was the regular stuff, confession once a week, stations of the cross during Lent, and learning hymns and prayers for special holy days like Christmas and Easter. I like going to church for music practice the best. Sister Claver would peer over the top of her nun glasses to find just the right note on her pitch pipe as she urged us to sing big. Jesus loves the sound of children's voices lifted in praise to him and his Father, she promised us. And since we spent most of our school day being shushed, we were only too glad to show them what we could do. Most times we lined up at the front door of our classroom, boys first, then girls, to be led out the door across the schoolyard and into the church. Once inside, we were not allowed to break rank as we waited our turn to dab our dirty fingertips into the holy water fount for a quick sign of the cross, then up the aisle to genuflect beside the next empty pew before filling in. But today it was different. It was bitterly cold outside, so we were being allowed the rare privilege of using the tunnel. The tunnel was an underground passage that traveled from the church basement under the playground to the basement of the school. It was lined with wiring and pipes and was creepy in a spiderwebby kind of way, but there's also a fascination and folklore surrounding the tunnel. You see, its entrance, the place where you journey from school to sanctity began, was the boys' bathroom. Us girls needed to be prepared to experience something so strange and forbidden, so the nuns handled it the same way they handled everything else that hinted at nudity or natural body functions. Now remember, when we go into the bathroom, the boys will go first and stay in line. Sister Mary Claver wagged her finger at them. Then the girls will follow. Hold hands and make your way through with your eyes closed tightly. I'll be standing by in case you get close to bumping into anything, and I will let you know when it's safe to look. What on earth could be in there that we were not supposed to see? Was it like the head of Medusa that would turn Catholic girls into stone at the slightest glance? And why was Sister Claver immune to its evil? We had only been allowed to use the tunnel a few times since I started at St. Catherine's, and I always did as I was told. Disobeying a nun was probably a mortal sin. But we were on our way to confession. I could get it off my soul right away. So this time, I decided to peek. The snake of fourth graders began to slither into the bathroom. The boys snug with their knowledge of the place inside out and out. I waited patiently, attached to Patricia in front and Marcia behind. I'd have to be really careful. Not only did I need to make sure Sister Claver didn't catch me, but if Marcia saw me looking, she'd tell. Of course, how could she do that if her eyes were closed? As we made our way into the mouth of hell, I decided to get my bearings. I knew by the rattle of the nun-sized rosary beads dangling from her belt that Sister Claver was on my right, so I turned my head the other way and was hit with a god-awful smell, like someone had peed on mothballs. When I got to what I reckoned was the middle of the room, I was ready. Not willing to risk blindness in both eyes, I opened just one. What a jip. There on the wall hung three white porcelain contraptions, and while I had never seen one before, it was obvious they had a practical boys' bathroom purpose. I felt duped. I had just committed my first mortal sin with nothing to show for it. All I could do now was confess to Father Vaughn and hope he didn't pile on so much penance I'd have to take prayers home for homework. We lined up for confession, and as soon as we got into church, and finally it was my turn, I opened the heavy oak confessional door and found the kneeler inside. There was a little wooden panel between the two compartments, the one with me in it, all let down and worried, and the other with the priest. When Father was ready, he would slide the panel door open, my signal to begin. And even though there was still a black cloth screen between us, because we were not supposed to see each other, I knew it would be Father Vaughn. He was the only priest we had. Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. It's been a week since my last confession. I disobeyed Sister Mary Claver and opened my eyes when we went through the boys' bathroom. It was the only time I ever heard a priest laugh out loud in church.
And that was Kathy Giroux reading once again from Serious Little Catholics. That's a great story. And it does, those, yeah, that smell, you described it really well. Now, St. Catherine's was St. Catherine's of Siena, right?
Correct.
And the church that I went to as up in, like, I don't know, from the age of three maybe until ninth grade was St. Catherine's of Siena.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
In Quarryville, Pennsylvania.
The Italian St. Catherine.
Yeah. But you were named after a different St. Catherine.
Yes, the Egyptian St. Catherine, St. Catherine of Alexandra.
Why did your mother choose her?
She liked the name Catherine. That was actually her middle name, so she named me after herself. So it didn't have anything to do with Saint's name, I don't think.
Oh, but in one of the stories, when you're supposed to write an essay or something about the saint you're named after, your mother said it was this Catherine. Why, do you know why she chose that one?
You know, I don't. You know, she didn't really tell me. But, you know, she must have gone through the same thing that I did. She didn't go to Catholic school, but she went to Sunday school. So she would have had the same kind of stuff. So I really don't know why, but she did tell me that. And I looked her up and I went, oh, wow, this is good, because this lady was a martyr and I kind of liked martyrs. So she had a creepy story. So I thought,
what is her story?
Let me think now. It was one of those things where somebody wanted to marry her, and she was a secret Catholic. And so, you know, they killed her because she wouldn't change her religion. And they tied her to a wheel, I think, because there's a Catherine wheel. Tied her to this wheel and on a chariot. And that's how she died.
Oh my
I know. They were so cruel as this girl.
That's pretty brutal.
Yeah, really, really.
And the weird thing is, you know, they teach little kids these really horrible, violent stories.
Well, I was at a monastery in their gift shop. Long story, but anyway, they had a book of you know, it was a recipe book, and they actually had a Catherine wheel bread thing where you.
No.
Wheel of bread. And I'm like, that's just terrible.
Yeah.
Kind of made me
chuckle. There's a lot of things like that when you think about it. It's like, wow, this is sort of morbid. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times it's their father who did it to them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and we hear stories about that, the honor killings.
Yeah, exactly.
I guess it wasn't that much different, except now we're appalled by it. I mean, we were appalled by the fact that it happened back then, but we celebrated the victims of it. Yeah, that's a little weird.
Yep.
So were there any stories from your childhood that you left out of the book because you're just like, no, this is too weird or too revealing?
Not really, no. There was one that I took out because it was a little, I had to make too much of it up to make it work. All right, well, this is a good story, but it's not completely, you know, honest. And it was about relics, about the relics of people who had died. And it was specifically about the relic of Jesus's foreskin.
Oh,
which
wow.
Cracked me up because it's the only and they said, well, this is really something because it's the only piece of him because, you know, Mary kept this because, you know, he was circumcised because, you know, he went into heaven. So there's no other piece of him. There's no other first class relic. They call that. There's no other first class relic. And actually, there's, you know, five or six of those around that all claim to be that relic. And most likely that never would have survived anything.
No. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's bizarre.
Yeah.
there's a lot of weird things about that we just like accepted when we were little.
Yeah.
And I shouldn't, you know, I'm sure there are people who still believe it and I don't want to disparage that belief either. It's kind of hard sometimes to, you know, have you had people who maybe are a little offended by that you're poking fun at some of these things?
You know, not that they've told me. No, not really. You know, I try and be, you know, this is, you know, I think writing it from the standpoint of being a child and being honest, well, here's what they said and here's how I feel about it. And, you know, and also there's one place where I talk about this one nun who was kind of confused. So you never really knew if she just had things mixed up or not.
Well, you know, that's one of the things that I think impressed me about this story is that you are writing it from the perspective of a child and it seems real. It seems like, yes, that's what you would have been thinking at that time. But how do you remember that? And, you know, because you layer, you know, when you look back on things in your childhood, you are layering on what you learned later and what you knew later.
Yeah. Well, one thing is, and this is where kind of my training with the metaphysical has been helpful because what you're kind of trained to do is to go back in to a certain place and just be real in that moment, put yourself back in that experience. And of course, you know, my experience, you know, people's experiences are not the same. But I can get pretty close, you know, I can get pretty close to remembering even where I was sitting, where this happened, you know, going back to the house where it happened and stuff like that. So there's that. Plus, again, we talked about it a lot, you know, with the kids when we get together. We still do. And we tell stories to our children and someday probably to our grandchildren when they're old enough to know, to understand it, you know, how funny this stuff was. And we would do that a lot. It was kind of our go-to, oh, remember when this happened? You remember the urinals, you know, that kind of thing. And, some of the other things that happened. And my mom would jump in and sometimes my dad too.
Now, when you, going back to She Writes Press, is it a situation where anyone who submits and is willing to pay they'll work with, or is it more competitive?
I think it's more competitive than that. I had to send the first, I can't remember now, 20 pages maybe of it. And then they wanted the whole thing. They said, yeah, we liked your 20 pages. Then they wanted the whole thing. The one thing that they do is there are different levels of how well it is edited. So if you've got something that I had mine professionally edited before I ever submitted it. So I was on the cost level of, we don't have that much work to do. Mostly it's going to be spelling, punctuation kind of stuff, not major edits. But I think they do reject people, that if they just go, no, this isn't a good story, or you just, you know, we can't well enough to it.
You're not ready.
Yeah, you're not ready. You need to learn how to write basically before then try it again.
And did you have any outside editing help before that?
Yeah, I did. I had one of my writers groups who was a published author and also had done a lot of editing. I had her do it. I paid her to do it. And it was, you know, you do it and you think, oh, I've got everything is just perfect. And I didn't have one page that I hadn't made a mistake on. So I'm real glad I did. And a lot of it was punctuation. I always tell everybody, hey, I learned my spelling and punctuation from the nuns. So I don't expect it to be perfect. Mm. You know, I never took any, you know, writing classes in college or anything like that. I was, you know, busy with special ed stuff. So.
Right. But like you said, learning how to tell a story is actually kind of challenging. What did it for you?
Just the feedback from the writers group and being really, you know, listening to somebody else and go, oh, that's how you do it. So, you know, and reading books on writing. I have, you know, a huge library full of books on writing, some of them better than others.
And with the writers group, you're not only learning from the critiques on your work, you're learning from the critiques on other people's work too.
That's right. I'm learning how to critique people. And I'm actually have a second writers group that I'm involved in that I haven't been in as long. And I'm learning from that one too. I've gone to writers conferences where I have seen authors that have published a lot of books that are still going to classes, going to writers' conferences. And I think good writers never think that they've got it, that they've done it as well as they can.
That is a very good point.
I think they're all...
And we're out of time. Okay. Yeah, and I just want to thank you for being with us today, Kathy.
Well, thank you. This was really fun.
And we always close with the quote, which usually when Caroline's with me, she comes up with the quote. And when she's not, I have to dig and find one myself. But I think this fits with our topic. It's from Thomas Paine. The world is my country. All mankind are my brethren. And to do good is my religion.
Ah, nice. That is lovely.
Yeah. Yep.
Lovely.
And thank you. And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Okay, thanks. Bye.